a partisan weapon in the hands of a segment of Lebanese society. It will be a weapon under the National Army's control, endorsed by a broad national consensus. That is one point. The second point is that Zionist Israel attacks Lebanon daily, claiming it is pursuing Hezbollah's weapons and anyone who cooperates with Hezbollah.
So it's okay for civilians to die?
There are assassinations and daily attacks on these depots. If those depots were handed over instead of exploding, if they were transferred to the army, wouldn't that be an added point of strength for Lebanon, rather than giving Zionist Israel a pretext to blow them up?
Didn't Syria do exactly that? Didn't Syria, the Syrian regime, that is now a very good friend with Israel, they're still bombing up until now the Syrian Arab Army's warehouses?
When Ahmad Sharaa's regime took power in Syria, Zionist Israel destroyed Bashar al-Assad's entire arsenal.
They're still doing it now, yesterday, in Homs, in Hama.
No, listen to me. Listen and focus. The Israeli entity army dismantled every major part of the Syrian military stockpile. It didn't destroy it while Bashar was still consolidating power, as if the Israelis had been comfortable with his being Iran's ally. They did not dismantle his arsenal the way they did when the regime came to power. I consider that the weapons are now in the hands of the regime and therefore could pose a threat to Zionist Israel. The Israeli entity neutralized everything the Syrian army possessed when the new regime arrived. Before that, Zionist Israel used to carry out strikes on Syria, but it didn't systematically destroy its naval and ground fleets and other capabilities like it did once the regime assumed control. Today, Zionist Israel says it wants to protect the Druze and Suwaida and is trying to create a David corridor. I am not debating Israeli entity ambitions with you. I am discussing what Lebanon's interest is today. Lebanon's interest right now is that any faction possessing weapons outside Lebanese legitimacy should hand those weapons over to the legitimate authority, specifically to President Joseph Hon, who was the army commander and is trusted by Lebanese. Nawaf Salam has a record of resistance and support for the Palestinian cause.
He was part of the 17th of April.
You can laugh as much as you like.
17th of May. He was part of the 17th of May treacherous agreement with
Nawaf Salam. He was
Nawaf Salam has nothing, neither near nor far, to do with the May 17th agreement. That is a rumor. That is a false rumor.
There are people who are with him who have gave witness ideas.
Give me any evidence for that. There is no evidence. It's just talk. Nawaf Salam's entire career and his work at the United Nations and the International Court of Justice are on the record. And there is a broad campaign against him in the United States, precisely because he supports the Palestinian cause. The minister who is allied with him, Omar Ibsat, has been the target of a long campaign because his wife at Columbia University supported Palestine. Nawaf's whole team comes under random fire from these people because they back the Palestinian cause. But when it comes to the Lebanese question, he acts in the interest of his country and its people. Today we must think about how to unite Lebanese and rebuild the state, because we have paid every price. Iran turned Lebanon into a front to defend its regime, not to defend Lebanese interests.
This is not true. I'm sorry, I have to say this is not true. Can you ask me why?
That is your opinion. As for mine, when Iran strikes, it fires missiles and hits Zionist Israel hard. But when Hassan Nasrallah is killed and Lebanese are killed, Iran watches and does nothing. We saw that in the last war. What did Iran do?
They reciprocated after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. But the Lebanese case, they retaliated. They retaliated in April and they retaliated again after the assassination of both Haniyeh and Nasrallah. But my point...
They struck inside Iran and assassinated a figure who was a guest in Iran. I am talking about the neutralization of Hezbollah's leadership. What was Iran's response? The Iranian response was nothing, not even a gesture to save face.
I think that the Lebanese people have enough men to defend their land. This is what they've been doing since 1982.
Iran fights only to preserve its regime. Sadly, using the last Arab Shia as a shield, not for those people themselves. I understand states act from interest and influence.
For people who are openly against the resistance.
It seems this will be the first and last time you come to see
me. No, definitely not. Definitely not. Because whatever happens, at the end of the day, we're both Lebanese and we believe that Lebanon deserves to be a peaceful place to live in for everyone. But you said something very important. You gave way for a solution to the problem, which is Hezbollah needs to give out the weapons so Israel wouldn't have a pretext to bomb.
I too want my country, a livable country.
What guarantees
sacrifices?
With Zionist Israel being a neighbor, that's near impossible. But what guarantee is? Let's say that disarmament happened. Okay, it was given to the Lebanese army. What guarantees can you provide as a member of parliament that Zionist Israel will not do the exact same thing it did in Syria to the Lebanese army?
Please allow me. You did not explain to me how Hezbollah is actually deterring Zionist Israel from attacking. Explain or show us. How does Hezbollah today prevent Zionist Israel from striking
Lebanon? There's a ceasefire.
Lebanon.
They're abiding by a ceasefire.
Israel manna miltazme yruhu halla ya'malu shi, am ya'malu shi, wala shay, mujarrad kalam.
Zionist Israel complies. Then they go do something. Are they doing anything? Not at all. Only words. An attack on anyone who tells them, look, this weapon no longer serves any purpose. It harms rather than helps. Think how to protect people after an environment that has already given so many martyrs and sacrifices. Save the people. I'll tell you, in the war, those who paid the heaviest price were Hezbollah's own community more than anyone else. All of Lebanon suffered. But the most affected are the people from that party's environment. And to this day, we risk dragging them into another slaughter, while the whole world seeks its own interests and self-protection. So, you can ask me why Syria didn't respond, why Qatar didn't act, why such and such happened. I care about my country that is destroyed again and again. Even in 1982, in solidarity with the Palestinians, Iran decided to arm a group of Shia in Lebanon and turn them into a front line to defend its regime.
They liberated South Lebanon.
From 1982 until today, they have used these people. In that context, there is no doubt that the South, which was originally occupied, as a result of wider conflicts extending beyond Lebanon, was liberated. But from all these years until today, Lebanon has slid into a frightening abyss economically, financially, and socially. Every 10 or 15 years, we suffer a devastating war. And the last war was the hardest. We hoped it would be the last. For it to be the last, Hezbollah's weapons must be removed and Lebanon completely neutralized. Tell me why Zionist Israel is not present in Jordan or Egypt or elsewhere and only wants to strike Lebanon. Lebanon gives it pretext. It provides the rationale of a supporting battle. You might tell me Zionist Israel would do it anyway. My duty is not to give a pretext when I cannot protect people. My duty, when I know I am making the weakest technological and military contributions, is to watch over the world. The primary political goal is the welfare of the people and their lives, not endlessly reciting slogans of pride and dignity while, in the end, they have no roof over their heads. Allow me. For me, this policy is destructive and deadly. My country has paid dearly for it.
So it was a decision by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah to die? He decided that he needs to die and kill everyone with him?
Unfortunately, he miscalculated. Lebanon paid the price. And of course, his constituency did too.
Wouldn't you want someone to have helped your father during his own genocide the way that Hezbollah tried to help the Palestinians when no one else cared about them?
Allow me to tell you how my father was helped. Armenians were killed and displaced, and some Arabs and Arab tribes helped some of the Armenians. At that time, some states stood with the Armenians and others stood with their own interests. Christian Germany stood with Turkey. Arabs stood by the Armenians. It was a struggle unlike the current conflict in every possible way. The two are not comparable. They are not comparable.
But there was death, destruction, genocide, kids being burned alive. That's exactly what happened in Gaza.
Yeah. True. So why doesn't Iran fight today for these people? If, as you claim, Iran should continue the war, it should not have stopped. It should not have let the IAEA re-enter. It should not have bowed to American demands. It should have sacrificed itself, continued supplying Gaza, and kept its missiles flying. It should have kept striking Israel regardless of the cost. That is what you are telling me, ma'am.
Would you have supported that if that happened?
You asked me, you compared what happened to my father and his people. It was not the same. They did not have the capacity to fight, so they were killed. Some Arabs stood with them, but those Arabs did not have the ability to wage war on Turkey. They did not want to start a war with the Ottoman authorities for the Armenians. What does that mean? How can you compare that to a situation today in which Iran can continue striking Zionist Israel, yet it chose not to?
And all the Arabs that are also being bombed by Israel, they can do the same.
You want me to keep the Lebanese front open and continue supporting Gaza, even through Iran, even though Iran, which is stronger than us, does not want to?
But there, we reached a ceasefire that did not take place in Lebanon. It was in November 27. It did not go into effect in Lebanon until 3 months later, where the Lebanese army should have taken control, and it didn't.
Zionist Israel today does not respect the ceasefire. We keep reminding Zionist Israel that it must stop its attacks. Answer me. Why doesn't Hezbollah respond to Zionist Israel? Because those weapons no longer deter or defend. Any military scholar today knows there is an unfortunate technological superiority and use of artificial intelligence that we Lebanese do not possess. If we decide to drag Lebanon into a new war, we are dragging Lebanese people into an unequal fight. People tell them, Allah is with you and will grant you victory. But this is not translated into reality on the ground. Will the killing continue?
Is this some sort of criticism against the ideology? Because I heard there was a trend, a criticism against the ideology, because there was a trend 2 weeks ago, because you said that Hezbollah's ideology is more dangerous than the armament itself inside of Hezbollah.
Thank you for pointing out that I said the Hezbollah ideology. I said the ideology of the weapons, the ideology behind the weapons. I did not speak about the Shia in any way.
I didn't say that because there's a video.
You didn't say that, and you were right. But others are running a campaign claiming that I was.
Doesn't matter because you know what you said.
I need to clarify because the campaign even reached Iran. Allow me to explain. The essence of the campaign was false, and they inserted the word Shia, which I never used. I spoke clearly about a specific ideology that Hezbollah follows.
This is my question. Is this a criticism of the ideology that more than 1.5 million people now embrace, which gives you there's a responsibility for you as an official person to maybe put a perspective in front of these people? How would you convince them with your topic?
If you let me continue, we can reach the point I want to make. I spoke about a political party just as I speak about the Muslim Brotherhood when I address them. I'm not speaking about all Sunnis. When I talk about the misdeeds of right-wing Christian parties, I'm not talking about all Christians. Shia ideology is one thing. Hezbollah is another. The Muslim Brotherhood is one thing. Sunnis are another. Parties that call themselves Christian are one thing. Christianity itself is another. This is a political distinction, and any other interpretation is wrong.
Convince me. I am a Lebanese from South Lebanon. Convince me that your point is valid when all of my beloved throughout the past years have been either buried, murdered, maimed, or detained by Zionist Israel, and the Lebanese government was nowhere to be found.
You have to convince me how the weapons protected you when many members of your family were killed, their homes destroyed, and all that. You have to convince me how the weapons protected you.
I'm the people. You're the government.
No, I am not the government at all. People elect me, meaning I run against everyone. So I am not in the government.
Yeah, but you support that decision by the government. So as a civilian, as a citizen, it's not my choice or my perspective to convince you. You should convince me. Do you think that Nawaf Salam is doing all his best to convince these people in specific?
Look, today Hezbollah's constituency needs to convince Nawaf Salam to continue protecting them through rationalizing Hezbollah by handing over the weapons and transforming Hezbollah into a political party like other parties, not an armed party bringing calamity to its own people.
When has he ever protected them? They're still dying. Where did he protect them?
Fine. Very good. Nawaf Salam claims that with these weapons, the killing will continue. You fall into a blatant contradiction because you are telling me to convince you how these weapons do not protect you.
Because you did you visit those people? Did you visit and talk to the people?
This has nothing to do with my question.
Did you visit to talk to those people, to tell them they should listen to Nawaf Salam?
I visited them multiple times and spoke to a large number of them.
After this war?
Many came to us, and we helped them without asking questions about backgrounds or affiliations or anything else.
Did you ask them about the
weapons?
During the war, we also helped people. Who drags people into the slaughter? The political decision. I spoke with them during the war and after the war. I also always met Hezbollah members of parliament and asked them, where are you taking Hezbollah's constituency and the people? And how long will this continue?
وإلى متى تستمرون بذلك?
What do they say?
لا جواب. البعض يتحدث أيضا ما هي الضمانات. طيب ما هي
No answer. Some talk about guarantees. What guarantees are there that keeping the weapons will lead to any different outcome? But I have a question for you. Allow me. If Iran today negotiated with the US and decided to relinquish its Lebanese card and asked Hezbollah to hand over the weapons, would Hezbollah comply? What guarantees would there be? Or does Hezbollah simply hand over the weapons when Iran tells them to?
I think the people have decided in South Lebanon that even if Hezbollah decides to disarm, they have every right to defend their own land, similar to what they were doing from 1936 to 1982. We will never leave our land to Zionist Israel. No matter
who is asking you to leave your land?
Did you ask me what happened to me or my family during the war and after it? I couldn't reach my house, and no one helped. The Lebanese government never helped. They put a condition that they will only do reconstruction unless we disarm the very people that protect us.
And the reason your house was allowed to be destroyed is the war of support and the presence of weapons. Zionist Israel considers those weapons.
This is what the Lebanese government is. This is what the Lebanese government is saying. I want to tell you that I'm enjoying this because we need this. We need this debate to happen. And sadly, we don't have more time to continue. But can you promise me that we can continue this later, especially after most probably what will happen to the Palestinian in Gaza in the upcoming weeks will be devastating.
I would love to continue this debate, and I would love to talk to you. But I want to tell you something.
All I am saying comes from a place of love, from a heart that cares for all of Lebanon. Because I do not discriminate between one Lebanese and another. My son belongs to the noble Shia sect. My son's name is Paul Mahdi. And I am proud of that. And when his dad decided he wanted to name him Paul, not I wanted to also give him an Arabic middle name. Because I do not recognize the borders drawn by Hezbollah or by parties that act as Hezbollah's replicas, claiming to oppose Hezbollah. I do not recognize any red lines between Lebanese citizens. What saddens me and grieves me is that once again, we are taking people based on sect and religion to their destruction and ruin, not for the interest of their country, but for Iran's interest. I understand that Iran has its own agendas and that it looks after the interests of its regime. My job is the interest of all Lebanese, whether Shia, Sunni, Armenian, whoever they are. And I thank you again for bearing with me.
It's my duty to do so. Thank you very much for this.
You also have to promise me that you will not cut any of my answers.
We never do that, and I promise you, on my show, we don't do that. I want to thank you very much for your contribution, ladies and gents. I want to thank you. Please do follow us, and we'll keep updating you from the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East stream. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 11th verse of Surah Al-Ankabut, so let's listen to the 10th and the 11th verse together, and we'll be back.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ومن الناس من يقول آمنا بالله فإذا أوذي في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةً النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ وَلَئِنْ جَاءَ نَصْرٌ مِّنْ رَبِّكَ لَيَقُولُنَّ إِنَّا كُنَّا مَعَكُمْ أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ.
And of the people are some who say, "We believe in Allah." But when one of them is harmed for the cause of Allah, they consider the trial of the people as if it were the punishment of Allah. But if victory comes from your Lord, they say, "Indeed, we were with you." Is not Allah most knowing of what is within the breasts of all creatures?
وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ.
And Allah will surely make evident those who believe, and He will surely make evident the hypocrites.
So, I presume we have discussed the 10th verse sufficiently, but since the 11th one is also the continuation of that verse, We will have a kind of combined discussion regarding these two verses. Now, you may remember in the previous episode, we discussed the fact that there are some hypocrites in the society that they claim we believe in Allah. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ. But when the situation happens, when this circumstance around them actually changes and they are hurt by the enemies of the Muslims because they have apparently or superficially claimed to be among the Muslims, they might be hurt in some way. They say, it's like the punishment of Allah. وَلَئِنْ جَاءَ نَصْرٌ مِنْ رَبِّكَ. But should there be any kind of help from your Lord, visible and palpable by them, they claim, إِنَّا كُنَّا مَعَكُمْ, we were with you. But the Almighty Allah actually says and warns that I am aware of your different situations and conditions and circumstances. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. Is not Allah the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? But throughout these kinds of trials and punishments and different kinds of changes in the society and circumstances and the situation, the hardships and challenges, وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ. And certainly Allah knows those who believe, and certainly He knows the hypocrites. So, if some simple-minded people think that they can be far from the dominance of the knowledge of Allah by concealing the facts, by just claiming that amanna, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ, we believe in Allah, they are in a manifest error. And again, we repeat that the application of the word hypocrites here is not the evidence upon thinking that these verses were revealed in Mecca. So, dear listeners, these two verses are to be seen together, since this one is actually attached to the 10th verse by the word wa in the beginning. وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَلَيَعْلَمَنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ. And certainly Allah knows those who believe, and certainly He knows those who are hypocrites. So, the verse is actually completing hujjah, completing the argument by saying that whatever you do, whatever you don't do, but you intend to do, Almighty Allah knows. He knows who is faithful, He knows who is believer, and He knows who is hypocrite. So, if the Almighty Allah has ordered the society of the Muslims to actually set up their interactions with the people based on apparent words that they claim. So if you say amanna billah, you are to be regarded as a Muslim in the society. But the fact is that the Almighty Allah is aware of your intentions. He is the only one who is aware of all the things that exist in all the people's breasts in the society of the Muslims and non-Muslims. So, وَلَّيَعْلَمَنَّ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. For sure the Almighty Allah knows. La ya'lamanna. This la is actually showing the emphasis of the Almighty Allah. Wala ya'lamanna Allahu alladhina amanu. Allah knows who believed. Wala ya'lamanna al-munafiqin. And it is interesting, there is this nuance here that the Almighty Allah says alladhina amanu, there were some people who believed. Wala ya'lamanna al-munafiqin, those who are hypocrites. There is a little difference in Arabic language between a verb and a noun. So you see, الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, those who believed, has this sense of action in it. That those who are believers, they are actually the ones who believed did something. But these munafiqeen has this sense of permanent in it, that their actually qualities are in them deep inside and it won't change even if they say that we believed. So it is true that the subject of hypocrisy usually appears after the victory of group and forming government, when the opponents change their features and form hidden or organization. But it was said before that hypocrisy has a vast scope of meaning and it envelops the persons of a weak belief who actually change their faith with a little pressure or with a little change in their environment and circumstances. And by that, we will conclude our discussion regarding 11th verse as well. Brothers and sisters, we have to ask the Almighty Allah to always keep us steady in the path of the true faithful ones. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Continue our journey through the province of Charmahal and Bakhtiari. We've set our sights on two villages that we've been told can thrill any traveler. But before we were able to dive into the architectural world of the villages of our choice, we came across a very beautiful pond 23 kilometers from Shahr-e Khor, located in the entertainment complex of Gerdab-e Ben, or Ben's Whirlpool, that's said to have an area of 38,000 square kilometers. The beautiful scenery and the sunshine reflected off the surface of the water were so tempting that we decided to take a few turns on the paddle boats. One of the things we all enjoy during the summer is a day out with family and friends. You can pack a picnic lunch, get out your favorite blanket and a couple of fun games, and spend the day outdoors. And there are a lot of places in the city of Ben, in Charmahal and Bakhtiari, where people do exactly that. With fully recharged batteries after our little fun detour on the pond, we set out towards our first destination, a remote village in the central Zagros Highlands. We have some 150 kilometers ahead of us before we reach the village of Saroghaseyed. To get to the Saroghaseyed village, you have to go past Kuhran County through a long and winding dirt road.
The Saroghaseyed village from afar, you'd think you were looking at beautiful stairways going up the side of the mountain. This kind of compact housing formation where your door opens onto the roof of the house that's right below you is rarely seen in Iran. Only a handful, and this is one of them. Apart from the amazing view, the upside to this interesting architecture is that everyone can have their own patio.
It's as though time stopped in this village at some point, for the architecture is still very similar to its original style. An architecture that's unique in the rural and urban context of the Bakhtiari settlements. Even so, the passage of the years has left its mark on the face of this village, on the houses that were built a few hundred years ago. I don't believe any of the images we show you can truly portray this scenery and the villagers' way of life. Our next destination is a village that's in the northeastern part of Charmahal and Bakhtiari, a village in the mountainous areas of the county of Saman along the riverbanks of Zoyande Rud.
Yasir Chah is a village that was built in the mountains during the Safavid era, so it's really old. The houses are built from clay, wood and brick, and some of the streets and alleys are still covered.
The name of the Yasir Chah village is derived from its geographical location. Most of the villagers speak the Turkish dialect, and in Turkish, Yasir Chah refers to a part of the river that's wider than the rest. The houses are heartwarmingly simple. Luckily, because of the interest tourists have shown in such places, most of the houses are being restored while keeping their original historic and old texture, turning some of them into ecotourism resorts. These historic and far-flung villages can entice any traveler. The calming experience of this adventure is hard to let go indeed. Hard as it is, nevertheless, we have to head back home. This is Golnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Qazvin is located next to one of Iran's main north-south transit corridors. Many people driving along this road also pay a visit to this historic city. And one of the reasons is to eat. So my curiosity dragged me all the way to downtown Qazvin to find out more about food culture in this city.
It is time to get ready for a festival of color and flavor. Everyone's invited. In the city's historic caravanserai lies a kitchen where they turn ingredients into magic. If there is one place you should forget about your diet, it would be right here.
If you're on a gastronomic journey across Iran, you would easily be able to find Iran's national dishes in every restaurant on your way. But to get a taste of more folklore food, sometimes you have to travel to particular areas of the country, such as Qazvin City. That is where I am right now, in one of its traditional restaurants. I suggest we take a look into the kitchen to see what Qazvini cuisine is all about.
Traditional Qazvini foods are made of some of the best ingredients in the world. It's a pity we can't show you the whole process of preparing all these dishes due to our short program. Only looking at each dish is enough to awaken that dragon in your belly.
In addition to exclusive dishes, the people in this city pay a lot of attention to what they drink. That's why traditional drinks made of herbs and seeds are extremely popular here. We're going to try one of the best cafes in town to see how the people in Qazvin cool down and relax, especially in a hot summer day like this.
In the old times, bathing had its own traditions. One of them was to treat yourself with traditional drinks called sharbat and brewed herbs after you came out of the bath. That was when the owner of the sharbat house prescribed you a drink that would help you shape up after a long bath. He did this by simply looking at the color of your face.
Our journey would not be complete without tasting the very special sweets and pastries of Qazvin City. Baklava or baklava. It's a bomb of energy and happiness, the richest and the most outstanding edible souvenir of Qazvin City. I'm going to have one, and then we're going to see how it's made.
To the people in Qazvin, baklava is pride. It is so important that no visitor leaves the city without it. In every corner of this country, you're guaranteed a warm and friendly hospitality. Iran, the land of endless flavors and new experiences. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Let's listen to it. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, that is the actual word of God, the Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we go for the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. They will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It all began with all the trappings of a traditional state visit. Horse-drawn carriage, royal pageantry, a formal greeting by the king, all behind the walls of this 11th century castle away from the public. But as the motorcade rolled, the marchers advanced in their thousands, a raucous sea of voices organized by the Trump Not Welcome coalition and allied groups making their ire clear.
He's a rapist. He is a racist. He is enabling and funding a genocide in Palestine. He is a nightmare in all ways for the values of the UK. He is funding tax cuts for the super rich by taking away the health care of ordinary people in the United States. He's got his goons out on the street disappearing people and bundling them into the back of vans so that they vanish without a trace. He is a danger to democracy in the United States and to prosperity and peace around the world.
The visit comes hot on the heels of the far-right march in London this past week, seeing a common threat with Trump's rhetoric. The UK says ties with the US are vital for trade. For the protesters, the moral cost outweighs the political calculus.
See the way some governments are behaving and our government is behaving is to get as close to Trump as they can in the hope of getting some crumbs from his table. You can sort of see that on the level of rationality of one country, but they are allowing it. By doing that, they are empowering him to carry on behaving in all these sorts of terrible ways around the world. So I think there's an alternative where these countries in the world say to Trump, no, we're not having your tariffs. We won't let you. We won't trade with you. If you do that to us, we will trade. And I think that's what they should be doing, is seeking to take him down.
While criticizing the UK government for inviting Trump in the first place, everyone here also highlighted Trump's enabling of Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians.
My primary message to Trump is, you're supplying the arms, you're supplying the political support, you're giving the diplomatic cover to Israel. You could stop the destruction of Gaza straight away if you wanted to.
I'm part of an encampment outside the American embassy where we are pointing out that the USA is funding the genocide in Palestine. And Trump is the face of genocide.
It's been a tumultuous week for the British Prime Minister, from the far-right march to a cabinet reshuffle to the sacking of his ambassador to the U.S. over links to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and the continued public pressure over his government's support for the Israeli regime.
Away from the pomp and pageantry extended to Donald Trump, the voices here say they want a different legacy, one not of spectacle, but of justice. They want the British government to ask itself, does it want to be remembered for its business deals with the United States or for complicity in genocide? Saipur is up in London.
In central Iran, Isfahan Science and Technology Park stands as the nation's largest hub for knowledge-based companies, home to more than 780 firms specializing in fields such as lasers, medical equipment, advanced manufacturing, and artificial intelligence. Today, the park reports a robust turnover, with $60 million in exports and steadily rising figures each year, as it builds stronger links to bring Iranian innovation to global markets. Here, ideas take shape, transforming vision into reality.
We have built links with Iran's major industries. Last year, companies in this park recorded a turnover of more than $550 million, and exports topped $60 million. In recent years, we've also forged ties with BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation members, and we look forward to expanding those connections.
In recent years, we have focused on the commercialization of knowledge-based companies, boosting production, and raising their export capacity.
These companies also benefit from being in this park, an advantage that helps them boost their exports.
This is our fourth year in the park, and we've really used the connections here. Last year, our exports hit about $10 million, and this year, we're aiming for $25 million.
Companies here rely on homegrown knowledge. They save hard currency, reduce dependence on imports, and keep Iran's industry running.
Like other knowledge-based firms, we turn to the steel industry. Our mission is clear: to localize our products, put them on the market, and remove the need for imports.
We've produced precision instruments, and with these products, we've saved the country significant foreign currency in 2021 and 2023 alone, more than $30 million.
Beyond the factory floor, the park is now a gateway to global markets, connecting Iranian innovation abroad and paving the way for growth.
Exporting millions in high-tech innovations each year, this science and technology park's knowledge-based ecosystem showcases Iran's economic strength, resilient in the face of Western sustained pressure. Alireza Akhbari, Isfahan.
Sudan has condemned the latest Israeli attack on the Qatari capital Doha, calling it a blatant act of aggression. At the Arab Islamic Emergency Summit hosted by Doha on Monday, Sudan's Sovereignty Council Chairman General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan described the strikes as a violation of international law and a direct threat to regional security. Sudan declared full solidarity with Qatar, its leadership, government, and people, urging decisive Arab Islamic and international action to confront Israeli aggression.
Qatar has always stood firmly with Sudan and liberation movements across the Arab and Islamic world, especially Palestine. Al-Burhan's visit shows Sudan's clear support for Qatar against aggression. These attacks proved one thing: America is no ally, and Qatar is not standing alone.
Back in Khartoum, the mood reflects widespread support for Qatar, denouncing Israel's repeated attacks on civilians and critical infrastructure. The public rejects these acts of aggression and occupation, calling for accountability, justice, and a halt to violence.
We welcome Al-Burhan's visit to Qatar and strongly condemn the Israeli aggression against our brotherly state. We call on all Arab and regional nations to stand in solidarity with Qatar.
The Sudanese people affirmed their full support for Qatar. We denounce Israel's aggression and extend appreciation to Al-Burhan and the government for responding to Qatar's invitation.
The Doha Emergency Summit concluded with a united front from Arab and Islamic states condemning Israeli aggression, which they said threatens global security. They also called for an end to the impunity Israel enjoys, emphasized the importance of upholding international law and supporting Palestinian rights. Israel struck a Doha residence last Tuesday, where Palestinian negotiators were discussing a peace proposal for Gaza.
From Khartoum to Doha, Sudan's people and leaders unite with Qatar against the Israeli aggression. Their call is urgent: peace, protection, and justice for all civilians. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
India's Supreme Court has struck down key provisions of a controversial new law that changes how properties donated by Muslims are owned and managed. The ruling follows intense debates and protests led by Muslims and opposition groups, arguing that the law infringes on Muslims' rights. They have welcomed the verdict, but say it is not enough.
I was expecting the court to stay the entire law, yet it's a good progress that it limited the powers the new law had granted in determining the status of donated property. We will continue our struggle for rights through legal ways.
The government says the new law called the Waqf Amendment Act 2025 makes managing Muslim-donated properties more transparent. Critics reject that. They say the law is a part of a broader political agenda by the ruling BJP party to marginalize Muslims.
There is a very high likelihood that the BJP will ensure that all Waqf properties are weakened. They will be rewarding encroachers. The result will be that the encroacher will become the owner of that property despite not having the title, because the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, decided that the limitation has to apply.
In Islam, a waqf refers to a charitable endowment made by people for the welfare of society. For India's Muslims, these assets hold great significance. That's because they support mosques, schools, cemeteries, and orphanages, and cannot be diverted for other purposes. Traditionally, their management has been regulated under the Waqf Act of 1995. However, in April, the government introduced amendments to the act, changing the process of managing Waqf properties.
Muslim groups allege the ruling party and its affiliates have promoted anti-Islamic policies since 2014, including communal violence, vigilantism, and demolition of Muslim-owned properties. They allege of being systematically oppressed through legislation such as the Waqf Bill to deprive Muslims of their donated land and to snatch their property rights under the Indian Constitution.
Activists claim India's Muslims face increasing intimidation under BJP policies that foster bias against minorities. The government denies this, insisting India is a democracy that guarantees equality for all. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
On Tuesday, some 5,000 people took to the streets of the Italian capital, Rome, to hold a rally in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians.